Welcome back to another episode of the Vertical Podcast. Glad you could join me today. Got a terrific show in store. Howard Beck, senior writer, Bleacher Report. He joins me in studio making his Vertical Podcast debut, and we cover everything. We talk about the Knicks, what they're getting in their new GM. We talk about LeBron James's future, Anthony Davis's future, Marc Gasol's future. We spin it forward with a whole bunch of guys and a whole bunch of stuff. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way to support it. Head over to Apple Podcast, also known as iTunes. Post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure we do this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. My guest this week is a friend of the radio program, but making his Vertical Podcast debut. You've read him in the New York Times. You now read him in Bleacher Report, and you watch him on videos nationwide. Howard Beck, senior writer over Bleacher Report. What's up, Howard?
What's going on, Chris? How has it taken me this long to get on a Vertical Podcast?
I don't know.
I feel somehow snubbed. I don't know.
It's been a while. It's been a while. We've been in existence for like a year and a half now, but better late than never, I guess.
I have not had you on the full 48 yet, so
that's true.
I guess you can say we're even on snubbing. Yeah. But now I owe you, which you're just gonna. I know you're just gonna lord it over me.
I absolutely
that and your better hair.
I'm going to actually start posting on Twitter once a week. When can I get on the full 48? That's Howard's podcast over at the Bleacher Report. The full 48. Download that. On iTunes as well. All right, Howard, I want to begin right here in New York with everything that's gone on with the Knicks over the last couple of weeks. They finally make what looks like a pretty sane move in bringing in Scott Perry to be the general manager. Steve Mills is still going to be the ultimate decision maker, but Perry comes in to provide some structure, maybe some experience within that front office. They talked to David Griffin, you know, they wanted a piece of Masai Ujiri. That never really got off the ground. What do you make of the Scott Perry hiring in New York?
You know, in a vacuum, I would call it encouraging because Scott Perry is a seasoned veteran executive who has been with, you know, some rougher franchises, but also a very successful Detroit Pistons franchise and was there when they were going to whatever it was, six straight Eastern Conference Finals and two finals and a championship. And he's been around. He gets it. He's a basketball guy. He's the kind of guy that I wanted Phil Jackson to hire, or as you call him, my boy Phil Jackson.
That's right.
Back when he took over, I thought that the only way that Phil Jackson, with no front office experience whatsoever, could do a decent job would be to get some guys who had been around, who understand the league, who evaluate talent as a matter of their repertoire. That wasn't Phil's strength. He wasn't a talent evaluator. He wasn't a cap guy. He didn't have all these other skill sets. And Scott Perry has that. And I think he's a good, solid hire for a front office that needs somebody like him because Steve Mills himself, though he's been the GM under Phil Jackson for the last few years, Steve Mills wasn't a basketball guy either. He was a business and marketing side guy. So you had the blind leading the blind with the Knicks, I thought. And that's not to discredit Phil Jackson's basketball knowledge and not to discredit Steve Mills's general knowledge. It's just that neither of them had ever done anything remotely like that job before. So, good hire with Scott Perry, but not the home run that they could have had, of course, if they had managed to land Masai Ujiri, which I think was always a long shot, or David Griffin. So instead, you have what I still consider a flawed construct. Steve Mills is the final stop. And Steve Mills, in my mind, I like Steve Mills. I think he's a smart guy. He's not the guy you want running your basketball operations because that's not what he's ever been. That's not his strength. There are guys around the league who have been doing this for years, and including Scott Perry. I don't understand this. I do understand it. It's a typical Garden hire, and I wrote about this at length today on Bleacher Report. You can look at my column. But basically, this is business as usual. Dolan hired the guy that he's comfortable with. The people who he put in place to lead this search targeted the right kind of people. Masai Ujiri, David Griffin, the guys that the Knicks used to never go after. That was the right call. But when they didn't get him, Dolan did what he always does. He went back to the guys who are loyal to him, who he's comfortable with, and that was Steve Mills.
Yeah, I agree with much of that. You look at Scott Perry and what he was to Sacramento. He was exactly what Sacramento needed.
Yes.
I mean, they needed a relationship guy. They needed someone that could connect with player agents and give Sacramento the credibility and the respectability that it just had lost over the last few years. I mean, Vlade Divac has, I think, a high basketball IQ, but he'd never done the job before. And Scott Perry comes in and gave them that credibility, someone that knew the terrain of the NBA and knew how to work it. My question with New York is I don't think of it as quite the same fit. I mean, Steve Mills, to me, is also a relationship guy. I don't think that the Knicks have ever had problems dealing with agents or communicating with players. I mean, Phil did, clearly, but I don't think Steve Mills had. And look, executives across the league, and you know this, Howard, they didn't call Phil Jackson's cell phone to discuss trades. They called Steve Mills. I mean, they were discussing stuff with Steve. So Steve already has that kind of skill set that Scott has. And then now you have to turn then to Scott's ability to be a talent evaluator. And this was less what he was charged with in Sacramento, and it's going to be more on his plate in New York. He's going to have to kind of be the point man on who they're drafting and what free agents they're going to go after. Now, you can only go up basically from here, because you know what's happened in the last week exemplifies just what kind of complete mess that front office has become. I mean, Phil Jackson's gone, but you know, 4 years, $71 million for Tim Hardaway. I know Scott Perry said he applauded that move from afar. I think that was just lip service. I don't believe that there was any applause outside of, you know, one that came with laughter when that deal was struck. Ron Baker, who are they bidding against for Ron Baker? Two-year deal at $8.9 million. Tell me a team in the league that would have given Ron Baker that. So they can only go up, but I just look at Scott Perry, and I'm not sure I would rank him, Howard, among the elite sort of personnel men in the NBA. I would say David Griffin, a much better personnel guy. Masai Ujiri, clearly elite at being a personnel guy. I think they don't need the relationship guy in New York. They need it in Sacramento. They need a talent evaluator in New York. And Scott Perry, to me, I don't want to criticize him for it because I don't think he deserves that, but the jury is definitely still out on him as a talent evaluator.
And that's fine. He's never been the top guy. He's not necessarily the top guy now. He's GM to Steve Mills as president. Every team has its own structure. But any way you look at this, he still appears to be the second in command. But it is the GM role that he's never had before. And so we will have a better opportunity to evaluate Scott Perry in this circumstance. Of course, part of the problem right now is he's coming to a team where they've already spent all the cap room on Tim Hardaway Jr., of all people. There's really not much left to do aside from maybe a Carmelo Anthony trade. So when does Scott Perry even get to put his stamp on this team? They've spent all their cap room. The draft has already passed. They already have a coach in place. I mean, you know, so this is the difficulty if you're Scott Perry, and it's the difficulty for us in trying to evaluate how his tenure is going to unfold, because there's just no room in the immediate term to really put a stamp on this. And even then, we're going to wonder, is this Scott Perry making those moves? Does this reflect on his wisdom? Does this reflect negatively or positively on him? Or does it reflect on Steve Mills? And something else I alluded to in the column I wrote today is that, you know, this is not his front office. This is the same group of people that the Knicks have had, and you know it as well as I do. This is like a permanent front office. I refer to it as the deep state. They've been there for 10, 15 years, some of these guys, through Isaiah, through Donnie Walsh, through Grunwald, through Mills, through Jackson, and Mills again. It's been the same group. And this is not a highly regarded group. You know, I'm not saying there aren't some good people there, because there absolutely are. But across the league, nobody's looking to the Knicks front office and saying, you're going to pluck your next great assistant GM or VP of personnel or somebody from the Knicks. No one's hiring from the Knicks front office. No one goes on from there to do anything. And they've had this same group there. And, you know, I've been waiting to see this. Is anybody going to try to create a real, to go for an overhaul and create a more modern, progressive, and bold front office? This is a very play it safe front office, and always has been. And with Steve Mills in charge, and Steve Mills has been there for 14 of the last 18 years at the Garden, I don't really expect there to be radical change. And as a result, I don't know that Scott Perry has much room to make an impact. I don't know that the Knicks, you know, have much room to evolve.
Why does Dolan not get this? Why does he continue to just fall back on the fiercely loyal? And I really only attribute it to the upper levels of the administration there, the Mills. You put Allen Houston on that list, the guys that have been in president, GM, assistant GM type of titles, the key basketball operations positions. Why does he keep falling back on this? I mean, he clearly thought he was making a strong move by bringing in Phil Jackson and giving him complete autonomy. Why does he keep falling back on these same guys? And they, like you said, they've been there for a decade plus, if not longer. And it's not like there is this rich tradition of success that they can fall back on. This team has been one of the worst teams in the NBA in the 21st century. Yep. They have. They've had basically one good season. And any other franchise in the NBA, if you have one good season out of 16 or 17, you're in for an overhaul. You're in for four overhauls over the course of 16 years. It's just mind-boggling how this the upper levels of this administration continue to remain the same. And the owner just seems to go about his business thinking, who cares? I'm making money. Nothing else matters.
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer, Chris, because, you know, look, not only can we not get inside the head of Jim Dolan, I'm not sure I'd ever want to try to get inside the head of Jim Dolan. I think it's probably a pretty scary place. I think there's an insecurity there. If you value loyalty and familiarity over actually making, you know, bold, smart moves, hiring, you know, people who, you know, I don't know this guy, but he's got a great rep, or, you know, other people I respect tell me this is a really smart basketball person. I mean, that's the thing. He's hiring comfort. He's hiring familiarity. Why, you know, why does he keep going back to Isaiah? Why does he bring Isaiah back into the fold after all the wreckage that Isaiah Thomas caused, and the humiliation that he caused, and the cost in that sexual harassment lawsuit? And he brought Isaiah Thomas back anyway to run the Liberty because Dolan values loyalty and familiarity and his version of friendship over competence, frankly. And, you know, he can't get out of his own way in this regard. Now, again, he started in the right place. He had Tim Leiwicki, respected sports executive who worked, you know, for Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment in Toronto, worked for Staples Center. He had Tim Leiwicki and Irving Azoff were basically his two-man search committee. And those are the guys who identified and went after Masai Ujiri. And those are the guys who pursued David Griffin. Not sure who else might have been on that list. But when those fell through, Dolan did what he, like I say, he always does. He hires Mills. Or he just promoted Mills. And then Mills hires Scott Perry. So there was an opportunity here to do something different for the Garden. You know if they'd gotten Masai, and you know if they'd gotten David Griffin, they would have come in demanding the authority to completely overhaul the basketball operations, which is absolutely what this franchise needs. Mm-hmm. And presumably, you know, obviously they didn't want to grant that. You know, we'll never know with Masai because I don't think they ever got past the stage of trying to extract him from his Raptors contract. In David Griffin's case, it's very clear from the reporting that's been out there and the reporting that I've done myself that David Griffin withdrew when it became clear he wasn't going to have the authority to hire his own people and to clean house. And so they're back where they've always been.
Yeah, and it's worth noting, by the way, with Scott Perry, that his most recent job before, you know, the 3 weeks in Sacramento, he was fired from a debacle of a team in Orlando. I mean, he wasn't the GM. That was Rob Hennigan's team down there. But, you know, that team is a mess right now with horrendous free agent signings, mediocre draft picks, you know, bad decision really after bad decision. Again, it wasn't his team, but he you know, let's not forget, we're only, what, 2-3 months removed from him being let go of there. So the jury's definitely still out on what they can get from Scott Perry. So we'll see on that one. All right, a team that's, Howard, that's moving in, I think, the right direction is on the other side of the coast, the Lakers. And you and I were both at Summer League watching Lonzo Ball play. You can't overreact to what you see at Summer League. But I'll tell you what, I really liked just sort of the intangibles of Lonzo Ball, he's not his father. He's not outspoken or gregarious. He just kind of is workmanlike and, you know, rebounded nicely from his first bad game to have, you know, four or five really good ones. He seems like he's built to play in Los Angeles, and he's obviously coming out of UCLA, but he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that's going to get flustered or feel overwhelmed by the pressure of being kind of anointed as the next Magic Johnson. It felt to me watching him, Howard, that they at least had a good chance at finding or at having a real franchise player in Lonzo. What did you think of what you saw?
Well, I was only in the gym for one of those games. Happened to be the game that LeBron James decided to attend as well. LeBron and I apparently are on the same schedule these days.
Clearly.
it was It was impressive. And, obviously I saw some on TV as well of Lonzo Ball. I hate trying, hard, fast conclusions from Summer League, because these are not NBA players they're competing against. The guys who are NBA players are other very young NBA players, or often fringe NBA players. And nothing will look the same when Lonzo Ball is actually on the court in October playing against NBA teams. That said, of course, you can't help but fall in love with the kid's passing, his court vision, and his instincts, and just his priorities. Like he never holds the ball longer than is necessary, it seems, especially when it comes to transition. The second that ball's in his hands, whether he got the defensive rebound or whether it was passed to him, he's immediately looking up court. He's passing ahead to guys in transition. He's not looking to control at all. He's not looking to make sure that he gets his first, or grind things to a halt so that he can orchestrate. He's looking for the first opening he can find. So, love that. At the same time, this is where we come back to the fact that it's Summer League. NBA coaches are going to be obviously honed in on this fact that he loves to push the ball ahead. And so that's going to be in the scouting report. And NBA players are bigger, longer, faster, taller, quicker than what you're seeing in Summer League. So some of those passes might be getting picked off in the NBA. Now, he'll adjust too. He's a smart player, and he's obviously a great passer, period. I think it's all going to translate. I'm just saying that a lot of what we see in Summer League, you can't say it automatically carries over, because the level of competition just isn't there, and the focus isn't there, and teams, they haven't seen him before. They're not necessarily ready for it. So I think the Lakers got themselves a special player. He will have a learning curve, and there will be struggles, and people will overreact to, just as they did in Summer League. They overreacted to the first game when he struggled, and went crazy when he lit it up with the near triple double or the 30-point game. We got to give him time like the rest of them. But I do think that, to the extent that we can draw some conclusions from his early performances, I think the Lakers got a good one.
And you know who liked his performance? You mentioned it, LeBron James. He was sitting there. I think you were sitting right behind him, right? You were in
I was. It was interesting, Chris. LeBron was carrying on like a running commentary almost. I couldn't hear everything, but you could hear him, basically commenting on everything. Oh, it's a great play. That's a great play. Oh, yeah, that's the shot. You want that shot. Like, he's just, the whole time, he's just talking under his breath or to his buddies who were with him. It was really interesting. Like, he's really into the game.
Yeah, and look, we both know LeBron James does not do anything unintentionally. There is a method to his madness, everything he does. I don't think it was unintentional, Howard, that he's at Summer League. The one game that he attends is a Laker game, and he's watching Lonzo Ball, and Lonzo Ball plays his best game. I know that's a lot of tea leaf reading, but we know LeBron's history. I mean, he doesn't make decisions spur of the moment. He didn't go into the summer of 2010 thinking, I think I want to be a Miami Heat and play with Chris Bosh and Dwayne Wade. That plan was hatched years in advance. Same thing with the Cavaliers' return. I mean, the ice was thawed between LeBron and Dan Gilbert, and at least the wheels were in motion well before he became an official free agent. I got to believe that there is, and I don't want to call it scouting per se, but him being at that game, that meant something. That being the only game he went to, that really meant something, I think.
Probably. I mean, I don't know. Was he on his way? Like, he skipped the ESPYs that night, but I think maybe he went to some ESPYs after parties or something. I mean, maybe he's on his way there anyway, stops off the private jet, says, hey, I want to go see, the hot new point guard in the NBA. I mean, listen, in the just pulling back from our conspiracy theories, which I'm not dismissing in this case necessarily, it's not beyond LeBron, who is a basketball geek, basketball junkie, to want to see the great new passer in the NBA live and in person. Like, if anybody's going to appreciate Lonzo Ball's game, his selflessness, his passing creativity, his court vision, it's going to be LeBron, right? So that's plausible. And a lot of NBA players, pass through the Summer League over the course of those couple of weeks. So again, not necessarily unusual, but that he comes in and sits there on the baseline seat for a Laker game of all things. And man, people, Chris, you know how this goes, because Las Vegas, it's just close enough to LA. A lot of Laker fans, probably, more Laker fans than in any other contingent in that arena. And they're all yelling, and you can hear everything at Thomas and Mack. You know, mm-hmm. they're all yelling, LeBron, come play for the Lakers. And, you know, I couldn't, we were right behind him, so I couldn't really see how he was reacting. But I have to imagine he was lapping that up.
Yeah, and look, this coincides with a USA Today story, Jeff Zilgit over at USA Today writing that LeBron is, and I'm paraphrasing here, disenchanted with all that's happened this offseason. I mean, again, it's a lot of tea leaf reading, Howard, but, I mean, you have LeBron putting it out there through an intermediary that he's not happy with how things have gone. David Griffin out as general manager, not any significant move made to upgrade the roster. And you have him at the Laker game. I just think, you know, it wouldn't surprise me at all to see LeBron this time next year be a member of the Lakers. I really wouldn't. Because of, you know, because of all the stuff we've heard leading up to this, and because of what we've seen the last couple of days.
Yeah, it's funny. I've said this a couple months ago, and you and I might have discussed this previously on the radio. A couple months ago, if someone said LeBron's leaving again, I would have been, come on, he's not leaving again. You know, he had this nice poetic return to Cleveland, and, you know, he had the essay with Lee Jenkins in Sports Illustrated, and it was all about it was going to be bigger than basketball, and, you know, you can't do this again. Now, I'm on the fence. I think I'm 50-50 about whether he's going to leave, although it's leaning more toward him leaving every day. When, you know, LeBron, when intermediaries are telling Jeff Zilgit at USA Today that he's disenchanted, when intermediaries were telling me a couple weeks ago that he was, you know, quote unquote, disappointed. And I can't remember what the other adjective was, but that he was disappointed about Griffin being let go as GM. These are all indicators that, you know, not only is he not happy necessarily with the direction, but they are also perhaps, you know, they're more than tea leaves. They may be the, you know, kind of lining the path here so that if and when the day comes that he has to leave or decides he has to leave, that, first of all, people won't be surprised, and it'll be very clear why he's doing it. You know, if this is about Dan Gilbert, the owner, and his decision making and the organization's direction, then he's got his out. And you can't say that on July 1st of 2018. You need to kind of lay the groundwork that, you know, and however you want to spin it, either it's the warning shot to the Cavs to get things in order. Or it's the laying the groundwork to say, when I do go, people will understand and they'll, you know, I'll have the benefit of the doubt because it'll be clear that you know, this franchise is no longer honoring its commitments to me. Therefore, I'm free to no longer honor any commitment to them.
Why is it owners are the last to know what the right thing to do is? We just talked about Dolan and what he's doing wrong. Dan Gilbert, by not, you know, going all out and spending what he needs to spend and giving autonomy to the right people, he's put himself in a predicament. Now, will LeBron leave because David Griffin's gone and Kobe Altman is replacing him? I don't know if it's as simple as that, but I think you can comfortably say that the Cavaliers' chances of retaining LeBron long-term are enhanced by having, you know, the best front office in basketball and spending the money you need to spend to bring in those front office executives. I don't understand, just like I don't understand Dolan's thinking with retaining all his people, I understand Dan Gilbert's thinking for not retaining his people, for not wanting to bring guys that have had enormous success over the last few years to keep them into the fold.
One of the things, one of the interesting aspects of LeBron's return to Cleveland 4 years ago, it has masked just how bad of an owner Dan Gilbert is. Dan Gilbert deserves to be on that same list with Jim Dolan among the worst owners in the NBA. And, you know, look, to their credit, both of them spend freely. In Dolan's case, he spends freely to win 35 games. In Gilbert's case, he spent, I think, maybe not so willingly, but knew that it was what he had to do to make sure that they could contend for championships every year that they had LeBron. So credit to them both for spending. But Dan Gilbert does not understand how to deal with people. He's, you know, people who have worked for him over the last, you know, 10 years, whatever it's been, you know, the horror stories, the verbal abuse, the way he treats people. It's no wonder that folks leave, and the atmosphere that he's created, that's what we're seeing in action here. When LeBron released that video, this was another one of those big tea leaves and another part of that, you know, kind of laying the groundwork. LeBron's media company released that video at the barbershop during the finals where, you know, he's there and Draymond Green's there and they're all talking about his return to Cleveland. And he's talking about how he had, you know, family members, his mom, friends all saying, don't go back to Cleveland, you know, because of Dan Gilbert. And he says him by, says it by name. Like, he's making it clear that whether that's his misgivings or concerns about Gilbert or just his family's, he's putting it out there that that was the main obstacle. And that here we are 4 years later, and that's clearly not gone away. Because why else put that out there?
Yeah, again, nothing is done unintentionally by LeBron or his camp. And all this makes me wonder exactly what he's thinking about at the moment. But I guess that's a problem that we'll be surely get into next year and moving forward. All right, so I want to ask you about what the came out of the NBA owners' meetings. And look, the timeout stuff is great. Speed up the game. I was sick of those third timeouts in the second and fourth quarter anyway, like everybody else. But the idea that reseeding is not on the table, that was interesting to me because I spent a lot of time in Vegas, and granted, this was coming from a lot of Western Conference executives, but there seemed to be a pretty strong groundswell of support for reseeding. And look, it's I understand that the teams like the Denvers and the Portlands and the teams that are in the back half of the Western Conference playoff bracket that may win 48 to 50 games and not get into the playoffs, it's frustrating, but there seemed to be some momentum to discuss reseeding. Adam Silver, you know, basically nipped that in the bud, said, and I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, said it really wasn't even discussed at the owners' meetings. It was discussed a couple of years ago, but not discussed this time around. They don't seem to be very interested, Howard, in doing that. Why do you think that reseeding isn't more of a big deal for the NBA office?
You know, I talked to an owner about this before the meetings last week, and I said, is there any movement for this? And he says it's never going to happen. They're never going to go 1 through 16 and break down the conferences. I said, how many owners would vote for it right now? He said, maybe 10. And look, the fact is owners are working out of self-interest here. You know, forget all the data about East versus West and how long the West has been the stronger conference, how many years the East has sent losing teams to the playoffs versus the West, or, you know, any other way you want to break it down. This is really comes down to self-interest, where if you're an owner in the Eastern Conference, and especially if you're the owner of a team that is middling to bad, you're thinking, hey, I've still got a chance at the playoffs. I've got a chance at that extra cash. I've got a chance, you know, even if we win 38 games, but hey, my fans now are happier because we got in the playoffs. They're going to act out of self-interest. And if you're, you know, in the West, maybe you're a little bit more amenable to it, but then you're also thinking, well, what if things turn the other way? I don't know. There's no easy answer. They're going to keep holding up that it's travel and all this. I think the travel thing is frankly BS. You can find.
Yeah.
First of all, they went to in the finals. You know, they spaced out games. They did other things to account for travel. The fact is, it's rare that you're not going to have Portland versus Miami in the first round every year. Okay.
Right.
Like, that's not going to happen. And by the way, the Western Conference is so spread out that those series are often, you know, ridiculous travel wise. Anyway, I covered the conference finals between the Minnesota Timberwolves and the Lakers back in the day. And that was, you know, 2-2, 1-1, 1-1. Thankfully that one ended in six, but my gosh, the flights between LA and Minneapolis, Chris, those are not short flights. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, flights between the West Coast and Memphis, New Orleans. I mean, these are Western Conference teams that are very far from the West Coast. So for the NBA to say it's about travel, I think is BS. I think the fact is they just don't have the appetite for this kind of radical change.
No, I mean, look, adding a couple of extra hours on for, you know, a D.C., the worst-case scenario, the Miami-Portland, you said, the Wizards Clippers in the first round. Look, it's a problem, but I would argue it's more of a problem for, like, the media and, you know, people in our position.
No doubt.
Because we're taking, like, the Delta connection through Atlanta, whereas these guys are boarding, you know, basically flying palaces. I mean, people that don't know what these planes are like nowadays, I mean, it's a double first-class seat for everybody. There are catered meals on the plane. Guys play cards with each other. They hang out. They can sleep. You could walk around. It's basically like an extension of your hotel. So I don't want to diminish the idea of, you know, I know that the NBA season can be a grind, especially when you get to January, February, these long 7-game road trips. But to call it prohibitive because of travel doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Maybe it would have been 25, 30 years ago when players and teams were flying commercial, and they did have to deal with this stuff. But now, I mean, you're basically the richest of the rich out there flying across the country. It shouldn't be a factor in making this decision. The idea of changing the schedule, I get some of that because, you know, the Eastern Conference teams beating up on each other, feeding on each other, makes it a little bit easier for those teams to potentially make the playoffs in a 1-16 format. But in the playoffs, I mean, you really have an issue with travel. I mean, these planes, man, Howard, they're pretty nice. They're pretty nice.
No, look, David Stern, when he was commissioner, is the one who once chastised Brian Mahoney of the AP on a conference call for daring to suggest that it would be difficult for the NBA to expand to Europe. And Stern was basically saying, you can fly to Europe, you know, just as quickly as you can fly from the East Coast to Portland or something like that. I mean, the NBA is the one that has always promoted the idea that hey, the world's shrinking, we can handle all this. That the playoffs would somehow be adversely affected by having too many East-West series. And again, there are other ways around this, Chris, and maybe this is a dumb idea. I've had a few in my time. But what if it's simply a matter of saying, let's just not have losing teams in the playoffs so that if, say, this coming season, if the 6th, 7th, and 8th best teams in the East have losing records, you sub in the 9th, 10th, 11th teams from the West, assuming that they had better records, and just make them the 6th, 7th, 8th teams in the Eastern bracket. So you leave the bracket intact. The top 8 teams in the West are still the top 8 teams in the West playing each other. But you knock out those 3 teams in the East that couldn't get to 500, they lose their spots, and the 3 best West teams that were below 8 move over to the East for that bracket for that year. I mean, that would be the simple, direct way of doing it. I don't know if that ultimately makes sense. There may be flaws in that idea, but it's not. You don't necessarily have to go straight up 1-16. I just want to see an NBA postseason in which no one gets there with 35 wins. And this coming season, and again, the NBA disagrees with me on this. I was debating this with one of their folks last week in Vegas. But I think there could be losing, you know, or at least 500 and below for the 6th, 7th, and 8th seeds this coming season because the East is just that awful right now.
I mean, I think the 8th seed in the East could have like 36 wins.
I think it might be less than that. I mean, they're saying mathematically, you know, because they're playing each other, they're going to beat each other up some. Okay, fair. But
maybe, but the top teams in the East, Howard, they're going to win
good.
Some games.
Yeah, like, no. Boston is really good. Cleveland's great. Toronto,
even
Washington,
Toronto, yeah.
So maybe they suck up enough. Now, again, I haven't done the math. I don't know how it would be. You know, how many times the 6-15 teams play each other, and whether it's possible to have the 6th, 7th, and 8th teams all be like say 38 and below. But I'm telling you, it would not surprise me, and it won't surprise me if the 8th seed is 35 or below. The East is god awful right now.
Yeah, no question. All right, I got some New Orleans people pissed off at me the other day with something I wrote again about Anthony Davis and, you know, the possibility that they'd have to put him on the trade block and explore options and Boston sort of lurking out there. And I think Boston, which still has infinite assets, I mean, they still are rich in these draft picks and young players, especially with Jason Tatum looking like he's a real player. I mean, again, summer league, whatever, but you know, when I look at the footwork on Jason Tatum, he does kind of remind me, as Walter McCarty told me, of a little bit of Paul Pierce back in his early days with how he shoots that mid-range shot, the one-footed fadeaway. So anyway, look, the Pelicans, it's going to take a miracle for them to get into the playoffs. I mean, they're trying out the Anthony Davis, DeMarcus Cousins thing. They just signed Rajon Rondo. I don't know how Rondo and Jrue Holiday works as a backcourt. From my perspective, I think if you're the Pelicans and you're going to play Davis and Cousins together, you want to surround them with shooters. I mean, Rondo is a non-shooter. You're going to put him out there on the floor, and how does that space the floor? How does it open it up? I just don't know how that whole situation works there. If you're New Orleans, and this wouldn't happen till at the earliest midseason, probably not till the end of next season, when Davis officially comes up on kind of that 2 years of guaranteed years on his contract. Do you explore, is there any scenario where you would explore trading Anthony Davis?
This is a dangerous question to be asking me in particular, because from the moment they acquired DeMarcus Cousins, my thought process went something like this. This isn't going to work. DeMarcus is going to leave after 1 year. Everybody's going to probably get fired. The Pelicans are going to end up in Seattle. Anthony Davis is going to demand a trade, probably before they get to Seattle. That's my doomsday scenario, and
he might like Seattle. Maybe the Rockets will not like Seattle.
I like Seattle. That's my doomsday scenario. That's my domino theory of, you know, everything just falls apart, starting with the Cousins trade. It's not that far-fetched. I mean, people might argue the Seattle part of it, but, New Orleans is hanging on by a thread in that city anyway. I'm not convinced that DeMarcus Cousins and Anthony Davis are going to work. A lot depended on how they reformatted the roster this summer, and they didn't. They did nothing. They've added no one of consequence. I don't count Rondo as a player of consequence at this stage of his career. They did re-sign Drew Holiday, which is a great move, but one, Drew Holiday has a really rough injury history, and two, they just signed Rajon Rondo. So now you've taken what you had in the front court, where it's not clear if DeMarcus Cousins and Anthony Davis actually make sense together, and you replicated that experiment to the back court, where you're putting two point guards together who may not make sense with each other. I mean, I don't get any part of this. I like a lot of people in that organization. I just don't see how this is going to work. This all feels a little desperate, and, you're right. They needed shooters. They didn't get them. I don't see where the upgrade is in this roster. I don't see any chance of them making the playoffs with as tough as the West has become.
Yeah. And if you're the Pelicans, there are going to be very few offers that make you pause for Anthony Davis. And let's spin it forward to next June. And let's say the ping pong balls fall Boston's way once again. The Nets are bad. They wind up at one. The Lakers, they land in the 2 through 5 range, let's say 3 overall, which allows Boston to get that pick next season. If Boston came with an offer headlined by 1-3 and, let's say, Jason Tatum, that's going to be hard for a team like New Orleans to turn down. Even though Davis is a great player, a transcendent player who is only in his mid-20s and does have 2 years left in his contract, if that offer came down the pipe, it'd be tough for me. If I'm, looking at this clearly from a New Orleans perspective, and I know that it's going to be tough, because after this year, if Cousins leaves and, Holiday's under contract, but that's really all you've got, you're starting over. You're rebuilding. So you then have 2 years to convince Anthony Davis that you're a place that he would want to be, and that New Orleans is where he should stay long term. That would be... That's a big risk to take, especially if that kind of offer was on the table from the Celtics.
This is why I said at the time that the Pelicans were the ones taking all the risk in that trade with Sacramento. I mean, granted, the Kings did not get value for DeMarcus Cousins. There's no arguing otherwise. But for what they wanted to do, which was basically to hit the reset button, if that's all they could get, okay, that's all they could get. And we can argue about, the value of that and whether they could have held out for more, blah, blah, blah. But the risk in that trade, squarely on New Orleans, because... You have the fit issue, and you just have the clock ticking, because Cousins can leave after one full season. And if they're not on the right path, and Anthony Davis is throwing up his hands and saying, well, that didn't work, and now he's gone too, we still don't have another star for me to play off of, and certainly not a complimentary one, where are we going? And when he's 2 years out from free agency, I mean, we just saw this. Paul George was 1 year out, so he had all the leverage in the world to force the trade. Jimmy Butler was 2 years out, and the Bulls had, misgivings or concerns about whether they wanted to pay him what he was going to be worth and all that. But 2 years out is when the clock really starts to tick, whether it's on your side or the player side. And so Anthony Davis at 2 years out from free agency, that's when things get very scary for the Pelicans. And yeah, this time next year, if not sooner, by, May or June of next year, that clock's going to be ticking very loudly if things go, as badly as I think they might, or even if they just simply miss the playoffs and DeMarcus Cousins decides to leave. Anthony Davis it's reasonable to think that he will want out and that his people will start pressing to get him out. And if you're the Boston Celtics and you're still sitting on that cash of picks and players, you are sitting so perfectly to make that kind of deal. And arguably, given Anthony Davis's talent and his age, this should be the best package we've seen in, decades for a single player. It should be the kind of package that blows you away, the kind of package that people thought they wanted to see Boston do for Paul George or Jimmy Butler. And that may be the package we finally see for Anthony Davis. And if the Celtics pull it off, all the people who were throwing tomatoes at Danny Ainge for not making deals are going to be thinking of him much differently.
All right, Howard, hang on for 1 second because I have to tell my listeners about the art of shaving. And anyone that knows me, and you know me well, knows that I absolutely hate shaving. If I could walk around with a 5 o'clock shadow, 3-day-old beard for my entire life, I would absolutely do it. Unfortunately, I can't do that. TV stuff and going to family parties and holidays, you got to shave every so often. The only thing I use nowadays, I'm serious, is the art of shaving. And the secret to a well-groomed guy is what we have here in the Art of Shaving. Founded in New York in 1996, the Art of Shaving has been helping guys look their best for over 20 years. The Art of Shaving has your total routine covered, whether shaving, beard maintenance, hair, skin, body, or fragrance. The Art of Shaving's award-winning products are formulated with the highest quality botanical ingredients, featuring pure essential oils. The four elements of a shave have been created to deliver smooth results every single day. You finish off the perfect shave with one of their five fragrances. Each cologne has been carefully assembled for a distinctive scent. The Art of Shaving offers a convenient replenishment service that allows you to save on your favorite products while never having to worry. I take advantage of that because I hate going to the supermarket or to the drugstore to get new shaving cream. I wait for it to come to the mail every couple of weeks. All right, our listeners here will receive 15% off their first order and free shipping by using the promo code MANIX. To get this offer, go online to theartofshaving.com, use my special promo code MANIX to get 15% off your first order and free shipping. Visit theartofshaving.com for this special offer or for a consultation with a grooming expert, step into one of the many retail locations near you. And now back to my conversation with Howard Beck. Well, the grumbling through the media is what comes next. And that's when you know you might be on kind of a path that you can't get off of if you're the Pelicans. So far, to this point, you know, whether it's through Davis's camp or, you know, even people asking Davis himself, he has not complained about the situation in New Orleans and where they are as a team and the direction that they're going. If we start reading, or we start writing for that matter, that people are, you know, in Davis's camp are saying that he's unhappy, that's the first kind of rock rolling down the mountain there, isn't it? Because, you know, that's how these things kind of start. We just talked about LeBron and you know, sort of the warning shot he threw across the bow of Gilbert through people with, you know, the whole direct knowledge of what he's thinking. We all kind of know where that's sort of coming from to some degree. You know, that's the kind of thing I think that comes next with the Pelicans if this thing with Cousins doesn't work out right away.
Yeah. Anthony Davis, I think, is, you know, it's not his personality to be the one, you know, he's I think the furthest thing from, you know, a prima donna type, but, you know, there's only so much losing that anybody will want to take, and your camp, your agent, your friends, family, advisors, they're the ones who eventually start pushing these things, and they're the ones who will be leaking to people like you and me if that discontent grows. And, you know, we'll know. I mean, we'll know soon enough. If this team, you know, loses, you know, 10 of its first 15 games, if they, you know, hit, you know, reach Christmas with a losing record, if it looks like they're falling out of the running quickly, the grumblings will be obvious and loud. And yeah, at that point, I would say then the clock is already ticking.
Yeah, no doubt. I want to ask you, though, too, about another player that, you know, or another team that could have a tough decision to make is maybe a little bit earlier than Davis. And that's Memphis with Marc Gasol. And, you know, I wrote a little bit about this last week and where Memphis is as a team. And they've had some significant losses over the last, you know, couple of months. I mean, you know, a bunch of their players are now playing for Sacramento with Vince going and of course, Zach Randolph exiting. That now they have a team that still has two, you know, very good top, you know, 5'10", in the case of Mike Conley, point guards, top five center, I think, still in Marc Gasol. But Marc Gasol, Howard, is 32 years old, and this does not look like a Memphis team that's going anywhere. And I know that Memphis, maybe things are different there where you – and I had this argument with Chris Vernon from The Ringer, and, you know, he's down in Memphis, and he was totally against the idea of trading Marc Gasol. I go the complete other way. I think you're almost like you try the season, you see if Chandler Parsons is healthy, and you see if you can, you know, build something with him as your kind of small ball sort of four. But if it doesn't work out there, I think you've got to be proactive with Marc Gasol. I really do. I think you can't. At 32 years old, this guy is going to be a depreciating asset, and if you can get something for him now, and it won't be dollar value, but if you can get something for him now, it's going to be more than what you could get for him a year from now or a year and a half from now or beyond that. I think that's something that's going to be a story this season if Memphis comes out of the gate and doesn't look like a playoff team.
Yeah, and I can't see them. I mean, I don't want to rule them out of the playoffs yet. You know,
it all comes down to Parsons to me, like if he can play.
Yeah, they've got to have that third piece. They just have to. And, you know, Zach Randolph is gone. Tony Allen likely gone. Vince Carter gone. I don't see who's, like, stepping up to fill some of the gaps there. And, yeah, to your point, you know, Conley and Gasol both have some mileage on them. And, you know, if you were in a position as the Grizzlies, if those guys weren't on the deals they were on, then they're making a lot of money. They're going to be making combined $50 million, I think, this coming season.
Yeah, a lot of money.
And then Chandler Parsons, I mean, that contract is just, I mean, that's, I would argue that's the worst contract in the NBA right now.
Remember we were celebrating, like, Memphis, small market team, getting a big-time free agent?
I wasn't. What happened there? I mean, the second they signed him, I thought, you're crazy, given his injury history the last couple years before they signed him. I thought it was nuts. And, you know, so if he doesn't get healthy, Chris, that contract's an albatross. If you just had Conley and Gasol and not Parsons, and you could say, listen, we've got two all-star caliber players, two of the best guys at their position, and we can reformat around them, and we're going to make the most of Marc Gasol's later years, and this has been his only NBA franchise, and, you know, we want him to retire here, and we're gonna do it like Dallas does with Dirk. We're just going to keep patching this thing up. We'll be a playoff team every year. Maybe we can't get to the title. We can't get to the finals, but we're going to be a really good team, and we're going to keep our character intact, and we're going to keep these really popular core players in Conley and Gasol. I would respect that. I would say that that's a rational way forward, but they don't have the flexibility to do it because of Chandler Parsons primarily, and to an extent because of Conley and Gasol's own contracts, which there's nothing you can do about that. That's what you pay for your franchise players. But I just don't see how you supplement properly to make the most of these next few years. And yeah, Chris, you're right. I don't know when that trigger point is. I think you're ready to make the trade right now. I'm not sure if I would, but I do think Atlanta's now the cautionary tale that there were people in that organization who thought, you know what, we've plateaued, and Paul Millsap is you know, on the wrong side of 30, and, you know, is going to want a big contract. Ended up being a little bit less than what everybody thought when he signed with Denver, but they could have traded him at the trade deadline and got a first round pick and maybe other assets. They didn't. They held on to him. He left for nothing. And this is different because Gasol is under contract through, you know, at least through 19, and I think a player option for 19-20. But, yeah, you're not going to get as much for him in a trade a year, two, three down the line. And if you're stalled out, there's always a case to be made that you flip that asset now while it still has value to try to replenish. And, you know, because if this is a small market team, it's really tough. Free agents are not going to Memphis or Indiana or Oklahoma, not all-stars. And so that's why Oklahoma makes the gamble on Paul George on a one-year deal. Mm-hmm. Because you either got to draft him or you got to trade for him. And to draft him, you've got to be bad. I mean, Marc Gasol is one of those rare cases, a second-round pick from the Lakers who they got in the trade for Pau Gasol. He becomes a franchise star. Are you going to hope history repeats? Because you're not going to find a ton of all-stars in the second round or late in the first round. So where else does Memphis go? Or do you just ride this thing out until it finally burns out, and then, you know, you pay the piper, you know, 4 years down the road, and then you start over?
That's a terrible philosophy. It really is to just ride it out with Mark. And, you know, I know he's an institution in Memphis. He's more interwoven into the community than his brother was down there. I mean, he's basically Memphis basketball right now. But at the same time, this is not a bad time to be really bad, because the NBA, it's a wrap for the next 3 or 4 years. Unless somebody gets significantly injured on Golden State, they're the champs. I mean, and the teams around Memphis are arming up. So San Antonio, Houston, go down the list. These teams are Oklahoma City. These teams are getting better. Whereas Memphis is getting, I don't say significantly, but they're getting a little bit worse because of some of the losses that they've absorbed in the last couple of years. If you can get a couple of first-round picks and some expiring contracts for Marc Gasol, I think you've got to at least consider it, because, you know, being bad, getting into the lottery, finding that next franchise player, that at least gives you hope that in the next 3 or 4 years you can potentially compete for a Western Conference Finals berth or even a championship down the line. Right now, they're a team that if they make the playoffs, it's a massive success. And that's going to continue moving forward as Mark gets older, as Mike Conley gets a little bit older, unless they can, you know, strike lightning in a bottle with some of these, you know, late first round picks, which is tough. They have a ceiling, and it's a very small ceiling. I would be, you know, they're not, I mean, I don't think they're taking calls on these guys now. In fact, I know they're not, but I would start being a little bit more proactive about this.
If this were strictly a basketball matter, Chris, like you and I are talking in the abstract here, right? We're saying like, what, how do you maximize what you have right now? Is this good enough to contend? No. Is it good enough to even be a strong playoff team? No. So like the pragmatic, cold-hearted decision would be flip these guys. I would agree. In the abstract, in a as a strictly a basketball decision, that's true and supportable. But there's the business side, and there's the human side. And the fact is, fans in Memphis have a really deep investment in Marc Gasol, who has been there since his high school days when he came with Pau and attended high school locally. Like they've known Marc Gasol since he was like 16 years old in Memphis.
Yeah.
And he's grown up with this organization, turned himself into an all-star, one of the best bigs in the NBA. And there's so much pride in this team. That whole grit and grind thing, it's become, you know, kind of just a throwaway line now. But in Memphis, that's very real. You feel it there. And the way that fans there identify with this team, to strip that away and go into a rebuild that could take, as you know, I mean, you know, these things are not, they're never quick. It can take 2, 3, 4, 5, even longer than that, years. What are you losing in the meantime? How many season ticket sales are you losing? You know, what does it do to your local TV contract if that comes up in the meantime? And I don't know what the status of that is right now. Mm-hmm. How much support do you just lose among your fans? And how long does it take to win them back? Those are the things that are really, I think, hard to factor in, you know, even, and as I say, it's easy for you and I to say, look, yes, on a practical level, flip Marc Gasol, get everything you can for him, start the rebuild so that you're ahead of the game and you still have Mike Conley to lean on. But I do think it's tougher than all that. It's more complicated.
Yeah, no question. All right, let me finish with this, Howard. The Rockets, they stunned everybody when they announced that they were for sale this week. Forbes has got him right around $1.6, $1.7 billion, but we both know that's basically the starting point. And, you know, for NBA teams, their valuations are significantly higher than what Forbes Forbes lists them as. I wouldn't be surprised to see the Rockets go for over $2 billion. I think $2.1 billion is a number I would look at right now because it's a feeding frenzy out there for these NBA teams. I mean, I mentioned the Marc Gasol being a depreciating asset. The NBA, their teams look at as appreciating assets. Like they're getting better because of this TV deal every single year. I mean, what do you think happens with this Rockets sale and how significant is it?
I mean, it's hugely significant in that one, the NBA is losing, I think, one of its best owners in Les Alexander, who's I think quietly been just one of the solid guys. He's part of the old guard, the guy, you know, one of the group that kind of, you know, predates obviously the Adam Silver era and predates all this new money era. He was a guy who, you know, was mostly content to just be in the background, write the checks, hire great people, let them do their thing. And, you know, that's the kind of owner every fan should want for their team. He is the antithesis of Jim Dolan and Dan Gilbert. And he's been successful. That team has had a lot of success. Obviously, the championships are pretty far back there, but just in terms of playoff appearances and consistently competing. And then on the business side of it, I mean, you said it. There's a really good chance that they'll be sold for the highest number in NBA history, and, you know, over $2 billion. And, you know, what that does for the league and where that resets the bar for the, you know, whatever the next sale to come may be. It's another indication of just how strong the NBA is right now.
Yeah, no question. The timing of it is interesting, as the Rockets are basically free spending out there with acquiring Chris Paul and, you know, basically guaranteeing James Harden close to $250 million. Now they're on the hunt for Carmelo Anthony, and that's kind of where I wanted to finish with Carmelo, and we started with the Knicks and where they are with Scott Perry. And look, Scott Perry I don't think he changes the Carmelo situation at all. I think they're way, way too far down this rabbit hole to come back out just because Scott Perry is a good relationship guy and knows Carmelo and might have a relationship with him. This is a complicated deal, Howard. I was reporting on some stuff last week. Portland, you know, trying to get in the mix. CJ McCollum tweeted out that picture of Carmelo in a Blazers jersey. I know Portland has been involved in talks as a facilitator. Maybe they get something out of it, get to offload a contract as well. But what do you see? Do you think that this time, not this time, a couple of months from now, Carmelo, do you still think he's a Knick? Do you think he's a Rocket? Do you think he's somewhere else? How do you see this Carmelo carousel kind of ending?
A week ago, I would have said, I think he's going to be a Rocket. It just felt like all the momentum was going there. That's kind of what my head told me. That's what my gut told me. That's what various limbs of mine told me. It just seemed like that's where it was going. It made a lot of sense, right? Like, the Rockets are always the team under Daryl Morey that wants to get every star they can get their hands on and is willing to take the risks to do it. There's a certain logic to Carmelo there. I could, you know, it's a tangent that we can get into, but I think there was a certain logic to him being there. At this point, with them having, you know, paused the trades, the trade discussions at minimum, and now incorporating Scott Perry with the Knicks and deciding where they're really going, you know that James Dolan, when it comes right down to it, would always rather just keep Carmelo. Again, Dolan just, you know, there's certain guys he has an affinity for, whether it's in the front office or players or whatever. He likes Carmelo. That was a trade that he basically made. And so I don't think he, you know, I think he'd prefer to keep him. Beyond that, you know, there's all the usual factors here. Where is Carmelo willing to go anywhere else? Would Portland, if they made a great offer, is he willing to play in Portland? I don't think we know that right now. Can the Knicks really afford to bring him into camp after everything that's happened? I would argue that with Phil Jackson gone, you could say that all the tension kind of goes with it. Now, it wasn't just Phil. There are other people in the organization who very much believe it was time to move on from Carmelo. But all the bad will, all the bad feelings, the remarks made, that was all Phil Jackson. He's gone. I think to that extent, there's not an urgency. On the other hand, the Knicks need to move on. Carmelo's 33. His best years are behind him. They've got to at some point decide to commit to Kristaps Porzingis. And, you know, that didn't really come up at yesterday's press conference with Steve Mills and Scott Perry and Jeff Hornacek, but it probably should have. With or without Carmelo Anthony, are the Knicks prepared to put the ball in Porzingis' hands, literally and figuratively, and say, it's your show now. Lead us forward. Because he's going into his third year, and I think it's time to shift. And can you do that with Carmelo still on board? I don't know how much sense that makes. I mean, they should move him. I don't know that they have to or that it's urgent, but they should. And so, long-winded answer, I got to believe he's in another uniform by opening night.
Yeah, I mean, being in Houston would be tremendous just because I'm dying to see how Carmelo and Mike D'Antoni work together. I'm dying to see it because clearly there's been, you know, the Rockets wouldn't be pursuing Carmelo unless they had a conversation with Mike D'Antoni and that this was okay by him. But you and I both know, Howard, that when things ended in New York, it was largely because Mike just couldn't coach Carmelo anymore. I mean, he just didn't have it in him. Like, you know, Carmelo was obstinate, didn't want to play the four, was a ball-stopping type of guy. Now, maybe Carmelo at this stage of his career is a different player. Maybe he's going to embrace being what he was with USA Basketball in Houston, which is a small ball type of power forward. And in that capacity, I think he's better suited to play Mike D'Antoni's offense. But man, you know, if you had told me however long ago it was that Mike was let go in New York, 4 or 5 years, that they would reunite once again, I would have said you're crazy because I didn't think either one of them wanted to be, you know, coached or played for by the other again.
I agree on all of that, and I was covering the Knicks at the time that all imploded. So, you know, far be it from me to diminish that. But it's been 5 years. Carmelo's that much older. Mike D'Antoni's that much older. They've worked together with USA Basketball. I don't think it's something that Mike would, you know, be thrilled about necessarily, but he's always a guy who has said, I can coach anybody. And if Carmelo's willing to play the four, which, by the way, was his best year in New York when he was forced into playing the four when Amari was out and they won 54 games that year. At this stage of his career, it makes the most sense. It's a small ball era anyway. It's not like he has to go out and, you know, bang against, you know, there's no, you know, Tim Duncan's to go bang against anymore. It's a small ball league. He can play the four. He'd be a great stretch four. He'd be playing with Chris Paul, one of his closest friends in the NBA. He's always had his best years, Carmelo, when he's played with strong-minded, all-star-type point guards. Jason Kidd, Chauncey Billups. He'd be great with Chris Paul. And I think that that alleviates the pressure on Mike D'Antoni because, you know, when the show was all about Carmelo in New York, then that's a relationship that's critical with between coach and franchise star. In Houston, James Harden's the franchise star. And Chris Paul is now the second most important player on that team, if you could even call Chris Paul second most important to anybody, given his Hall of Fame resume. Carmelo goes in as the third wheel, but as one who could be incredibly effective playing off those guys. So I just think the context would be different. And if you can put aside whatever bad feelings are lingering from 2012, I think they'd be all right.
Yeah, we'll see. I don't know how that works. I really don't. But we still have to figure out Chris Paul and James Harden. I think they will figure it out because they're both they need each other at this stage of their careers. But I mean, man, that would be an interesting team in Houston if Carmelo's added to the mix. And I still don't think they're not on Golden State's level. I wouldn't think they're on San Antonio's level even though the Spurs losing Jonathan Simmons, that hurts them, and we'll see what else they can do, Pau Gasol moving forward. But that's an interesting team, to say the least. Anyway. All right, Howard, appreciate it, man. Welcome to the Vertical Podcast family, so to speak, and thanks for coming to join me.
Appreciate it, Chris. Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Howard Beck for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.